from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 3 months after the fall of Saddam, Bush administration officials now own that the path to Iraqi reconstruction looks more daunting, more expensive, and more time-consuming than ever. U.S. troops continue to be shattered by attacks and casualties. Washington is looking at years of boots on the ground and many billions planted in the seeds of a new Iraq. Tonight on Point, Iraq moves from enduring freedom to endurance test. We begin in Baghdad, where 25 prominent Iraqis from diverse political, ethnic, and religious backgrounds shared a stage yesterday and declared themselves the first interim government of Iraq. U.S. Civilian Occupation Administrator Paul Bremer remains very much in charge. But over weeks of negotiations, American occupation leaders agreed to surrender considerable executive powers to the new hand-picked governing council. The group met for its first continuous session today to decide on a rotating presidency. Colin Soloway is in Baghdad for Newsweek magazine. I asked him how the Iraqi people are responding to the formation of the council.
As virtually anything that the Americans are producing at this point, I think is being received with some degree of skepticism by Iraqis. I think that's understandable. I mean, there's a great deal of disillusionment with the American presence here, largely because of the failure to really provide decent security in Baghdad and electricity and water, the sort of basics. I mean, people are extremely frustrated, and I think that while this is certainly a response to what many Iraqis were calling for, saying we want representation, we want to have Iraqis really running things, I think at the same time, people are going to be watching very carefully to see what this council actually delivers. And I think its legitimacy will largely depend on what it actually can deliver, either in cooperation with or despite the Americans.
What exactly is the role of the new council to be? What exactly are its powers?
Well, it has a lot more power than Paul Bremer had originally envisaged. He had originally envisaged it purely as sort of an advisory body, which would sort of suggest to him intelligent things to do. But I think it, in response to the violence, to the sort of growing resistance to American occupation, and really growing frustration on the part of Iraqis, particularly people in Baghdad, well, one should emphasize this is in Baghdad largely, that the Americans needed help. That they needed help from Iraqis who could actually talk to Iraqis and transmit the concerns of Iraqis to the Americans. And I think, to be quite honestly, from a purely pragmatic and, let's say, rather cynical standpoint, the Americans, I think, wanted someone to share responsibility for this, share responsibility for what has been a pretty, really not particularly well-run occupation. And I think they'd like to have some Iraqis who they can put out front for Iraqis to complain to and Iraqis to point to in hopes that this will diffuse the sort of sense that this is an occupation and that the Americans are entirely responsible for the problems.
Several members of the council told the press that they had been assured that Paul Bremer would not exercise a veto over the council's decision. So what about it? Where does the buck stop now in Iraq?
Well, in the end, ultimately, it stops with Paul Bremer, and I think the administration has been clear about that as well, that the Coalition Provisional Authority is the government of Iraq. But I think Bremer is giving them the opportunity to actually start taking charge of things, and if they do, in his eyes anyway, or hopefully in most Iraqis' eyes, a good job of starting to get the administration started, putting people in charge of ministries, establishing a cabinet, establishing a constitutional a committee to start work on a constitutional convention, you know, there's no reason necessarily why he didn't necessarily have to veto them. The argument is simply, I mean, you know, they can't do much worse than Bremer and the Americans have been doing so far, at least in terms of providing the basic need for Iraqis. So why not give them a chance here, as, you know, under sort of American tutelage?
And Colin, what about the makeup of the council? What does it suggest about how it might or might not be able to work together? You've got a Shiite majority, you've got Sunnis, Kurds, Turkmens, Assyrian Christians. Is this a workable body? It's a large body.
It is a large body, but I think, to be honest, I'm not sure that these sorts of divisions will necessarily manifest themselves at the moment. Right now, what the council is really going to be largely dealing with are really some fundamentals of just simply getting a government up and running, of getting some administration up and running, of appointing people to the Constitutional Convention, or committees to establish a Constitutional Convention, and work on establishing the structures of a new government. So I don't think there's going to be this sort of political issues or political battles between various groups that you'll probably have later on once the political stakes become higher. At the moment, it's largely, I think, going to be dealing with a lot of basic nuts and bolts issues, trying to get services working, trying to get the country running again.
Will there be a chairman of this council or a leader of this group? Will that be shared? How is the executive angle of the council to work?
Well, as I understand it, and it seems to be sort of changing, you're never quite sure. Different people say different things, but there will be a rotating president or presidency of the council. It's not clear whether it'll be a single person or three members. There was supposed to be a decision today on who the president or chairman of this council was going to be, and they didn't reach it. But they claim that they will find someone in the near future. But honestly, I'm not sure. I mean, frankly, being president of the council or being in charge of any sort of interim government at this point is kind of a booby prize, frankly, simply because you're the one who's going to be out in front of Iraqis taking the heat for lots of things that you can't control. Remember, these people will not control the budget. They basically can't do much more than say, this is who we want in the government. But the Americans are going to be controlling the budget, and the Americans are going to be responsible for providing the logistic support that the council and that any new sort of Iraqi government or semi-government is going to need. So, you know, I think they're going to be in a situation where they're going to be asking for an awful lot. You're not dealing with a particularly rapid and swift or efficient operation here from the American provisional authorities. So, you know, being on this council may end up being a poison chalice for a number of people politically in the future.
Colin Sulloway, thanks so much for joining us.
No problem.
Colin Sulloway is contributing editor for Newsweek magazine. He spoke with us from Baghdad. Nobody said it would be easy, but a few almost did. And now the aftermath of all-out war in Iraq is very, very hard. The oil fields that were supposed to underwrite reconstruction aren't up to pre-war production levels by any means. Electricity, water, and neighborhood security are still in maddeningly short supply. And each day, more than 148,000 American troops sweat it out in the crosshairs of a mounting guerrilla resistance. Occupation czar Paul Bremer said this weekend that freedom is on the march in Iraq. But it's a hard march so far. How many years, how many lives, and how many billions are you ready to spend to rebuild Iraq? Should the rest of the world step up and help, or is this America's baby? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from outside Washington is James Pinkerton, Newsday columnist, Fox News contributor, a fellow with the New America Foundation. He returned from Iraq just 2 weeks ago. Good evening and welcome, James Pinkerton.
Thank you very much, and please call me Jim.
You got it. Jim, thanks for joining us tonight. You're just back a couple of weeks from Iraq. You've been watching the news tumble out of there ever since you got back, and while you were there, we're around for the kind of killings going on, the kind of chaos that we read is still on the ground there. What is your sense of how great a miscalculation is playing out here? What was expected? What have we got?
Well, I mean, what was apparently expected from the administration was, in this case at least, what they said before the war, which was that we would be greeted as liberators. They all said that in a run-up in March. Dick Cheney said that there would be jubilation in the streets. Paul Wolfowitz said it would be like Paris in 1944. And I kind of wondered myself whether they really believed that. And now, having been over there last month for a couple weeks, I sort of concluded that they did, because they were clearly unprepared for what they ran up against once they got there.
Which suggests that what was anticipated was really more than rose petals in the streets and being greeted as liberators. It would seem, from reports that we've read, including some of yours, Jim Pinkerton, that they expected much of Iraq's government to remain intact, Garner's people were told to bring two suits with them because they'd be walking into more or less intact ministries, which were instead trashed and abandoned.
Right. The looting clearly took them by surprise. And let's also say that Saddam Hussein was extremely unpopular, and the Iraqi people were delighted to get rid of him, which unfortunately had the additional manifestation of trashing much of the country. What the Americans miscalculated on was, I believe, to put it bluntly, the volatility of the Iraqi population, and therefore they failed on such seemingly elementary peacekeeping post-war functions as equipping themselves with non-lethal weapons.
And so they were firing into crowds, Iraqis died, and maybe they're the start of popular resentment of the U.S., though implicit in what you're saying, Jim Pinkerton, is that this was widespread volatility in the populace and not a deliberate strategy by Saddam remnants to deprive the American occupiers of a foundation for rebuilding.
I don't really see a lot of evidence that there's a network of Saddam loyalists out there. Again, he was very unpopular in substantial parts of the country. On the other hand, the country is extremely well-armed. Everybody I talked to said that they had a gun. I asked one fellow, I said, what percentage do you think of the country has a gun? And he said, oh, over 100%. And I think that is what you're up against, is that there's just a lot of people there who are armed and they get angry. I mean, for example, there were 400,000 soldiers in the Iraqi army pre-war. If the estimates are correct, we killed perhaps 3,000 of them. So that leaves 397,000 Iraqi soldiers who were demobilized, effectively, when the war ended. And the initial decision was to simply not pay them. I actually went to a protest in front of the Republican Palace, which is the coalition headquarters, where two Iraqis were killed. Again, no non-lethal weapons. There was no alternative to shooting, I mean, at least other than just giving up. I mean, they had no tear gas, they had no water cannon, they had no batons. So they fired into the crowd, killed two Iraqis. Obviously, that upset the Iraqis a good deal. And then a few weeks later, they'd made the somewhat belated decision to pay them after all. So now we have 397,000 Iraqi men on the payroll with nothing to do. There's not really an economy there. So they're collecting a paycheck, kind of, and sitting there with their guns and kind of watching the news and reacting however it is that Iraqis might react. And we can all judge that from the TV. Some love us, some hate us, and some are in between.
And that was just part of the surprise. There was, of course, an expectation that American troops would be coming home. Donald Reagan said over the weekend, Secretary of Defense, that in fact we may be sending more troops there. It's possible. And people are already saying that the troops will not be back for a couple of years, maybe even 4 years, maybe more. The cost of this occupation, which was roughly estimated at $2 billion a month, seems to have doubled to $4 billion a month now. The U.S. has reached out for foreign assistance, for the help of other countries in the occupation. India was asked for 17,000 troops, just said no. Jim Pinkerton, you sat with Paul Bremer in Baghdad. How's he doing?
Well, I mean, your previous interviewee, the fellow from who was in Baghdad, still painted a
Newsweek.
Bleaker picture than what I saw. Of course, it has been, again, almost 2 weeks since I came back, so I'm not going to dispute what he's saying. It is a difficult situation. Bremer, I think, has a lot of ideas. He is sort of simultaneously forceful, just personally in terms of style, without being particularly ideological. So I think he's sort of there to kind of do a good job in kind of a forceful, energetic way, and I think that's what he thinks he's going to do. I do think there are some serious misconceptions about what's best for the future of Iraq. For example, it's not at all clear to me, having been there and having studied the place fairly closely, as we all have for the last few years, that Iraq should be Iraq, that it should be one country. It was three provinces under the Ottoman Empire for the Turks. The British kind of glued it together for their own administrative convenience after World War I, and to this day there is an obvious dividing line between the Kurds in the north, the Sunni Muslims in the middle, and the Shi'i Muslims in the south. And given the track record of post-World War I countries that were glued together, such as Czechoslovakia and Yugoslavia and Ethiopia, you wonder whether it's such a good idea. And I actually put that question to Bremer in Baghdad, and he just looked at me like I crawled out from under a rock.
I'm sure he did that. Those are hardly his instructions to
exactly.
go and break up this country.
Exactly. He said President Bush wants a peaceful and unified Iraq. Okay, well, that's what President Bush wants, but eventually we're going to have to listen to the Iraqis.
But it may be that the U.S. has a similar strategic interest to the British in holding that country together as a bulwark in between Turks and Persians and everybody else. Jim Pinkerton, please stand by. We're talking tonight about Iraq for the long haul, about chaos, guerrilla war, and an endurance test for the United States. You can join the conversation. Does America have the wherewithal, the will, to rebuild this country, to get this job done. How many years, how many billions, how many lives are you ready to spend? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Iraq for the long haul, about chaos and guerrilla war and an endurance test for the United States in Iraq. My guest tonight is James Pinkerton, former White House aide to the Reagan and first George Bush administrations. He's a Newsday columnist, a Fox News contributor. He's just returned from Iraq a couple of weeks ago and seen a lot while he was there. You can join this conversation as well. Should heads roll for the bad start, the poor planning, or are you just looking ahead to a stable, democratic Iraq ASAP? Can you feel when this project might turn the corner? Or is this a long-term shooting gallery for American GIs? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jim Pinkerton, I think most Americans, most of all, would like to see Iraq turn the country, find its feet, get an economy going, have the freedom they deserve and get a democracy underway, and God bless them. Did you see the chance for that out there? Tell us you see some possibility.
Well, what I saw was an astonishing amount of idealism among the American soldiers there and Marines. Many of them said, you know, I don't want to go home until I finished what I'm doing here. I realize that there's a lot of stories about morale, and I have no doubt that, you know, many, if not most, do in fact want to come home. But there's a good number. They're all volunteers. They've actually been sort of soaked up in all the kind of Bush doctrine of democracy building and spreading the flag and so on.
Sure.
And they're anxious to, you know, provide roads and schools and health care.
Well, they don't want to come home a failure. That's understandable. Who wouldn't want to leave behind a better country up on the rails?
Well, that's exactly right. In Al-Kut, which is about 150 miles southeast of Baghdad, I met a lieutenant colonel in the Marines, a reservist, who was actually a Medicare administrator in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, in real life. And, you know, he walks around without a helmet on, without a bulletproof vest on, without a gun, just schmoozes with the Iraqis. They seem to like him back. He's given tons of Iraqis weapons as part of the police force there. I mean, I think that there are islands of great progress. Again, this is in a more Shi'i area, and I think the Shi'i have made a kind of collective decision to play ball with the Americans.
But there you're talking about the will of the American soldiers who are there, their desire to come home with a successful Iraq behind them, and who couldn't relate to that, and it's admirable as can be. But the circumstances on the ground, do you see how Bremer and the Iraqis in power, whoever they may be, can put one foot in front of another and end up at a result that's going to let those American soldiers come home and say, look at that, we're proud of that?
I would call it doubtful. I would say that right now, or at least when I was there, and maybe the numbers have changed slightly, but 10% of the Iraqi people want us to stay forever. They want to be merged into the United States. One Iraqi told me with a straight face, I want Ariel Sharon to lead this country.
What?
I'm dead serious. I asked, that was my reaction. I said, do you really mean the Israeli prime minister not known as a friend of the Arabs? And he said, yes. And his argument was, anybody other than the usual gang of thugs from the police and the military that are running the country into the ground for 35 years would be an improvement.
One can imagine the U.S. staying around the oil fields for a long time, but in the old country forever, it's hard to imagine.
Well, that's right. I mean, many Iraqis, by the way, probably most, really aren't that interested in democracy. What they want is security. What they want is what they would call a strong man, a strong leadership.
Well, so 10% who are happy for Americans there, and the other 90?
Well, the other 50, I would say, want us to stay as long as we're sort of visibly helping. And that's where your earlier the fellow from Newsweek was a little discouraging on that score, because that what he was seeing on the ground now is suggesting that popular support, that sort of middle ground, if you will, is sort of fading a bit. And I guess the other 40% just plain want us gone now. And, of course, that's about 10 million people. And they're all armed. And they are, and again, I emphasize this, there's a volatility. There's a temperamentalness. I mean, it has something to do with the weather, I suppose. It's 120 degrees every day or more. It has something to do with sort of the Mediterranean culture of the place. It's just It is people are losing their temper all the time there.
Well, who wouldn't want an occupation force out at some level, I suppose, no matter who it is? Jim Pinkerton, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Jonathan Landay. He's joining us from Washington. He's national security correspondent with Knight Ridder, Washington Bureau. Good evening and welcome, Jonathan Landay.
Hi there.
Thanks for joining us. Jonathan, you and a team that you worked with have looked just in the last couple of days at the decision-making process and presumptions that went into planning for post-war Iraq's circumstances. How far off the mark were the top planners in the Pentagon?
Actually, I've got to say that my colleague Warren Strobel and I have been reporting on this and the questions of intelligence and interpretations of intelligence for almost a year now.
Mm-hmm.
And in our latest article over this last weekend, we report based on interviews with more than a dozen current and former senior and mid-level officials that the contingencies, the things that we've seen happen over the last several months since the end of the war were not anticipated in the post-war planning by this small circle of senior civilians in the Defense Department.
Mm-hmm.
Because their plan basically came down to one man, Ahmad Chalabi of the Iraqi National Congress.
Right.
The plan was basically based on their own interpretations of intelligence and analysis of Iraq, that the Americans would be by and large overwhelmingly welcomed into Iraq, that Mr. Chalabi commanded considerable support, secret though it be, within the security services and outside the regime,
mm-hmm.
and that once the Americans came in, everybody would welcome them. Mr. Chalabi, the top layers of the Iraqi regime would have been removed, and Mr. Chalabi and his associates would be put on the top.
So in light of events, how does that presumption look?
Well, there was no plan B. That presumption was completely wrong. Because it turned out that Mr. Chalabi did not command the popular support that the people in the Pentagon and he himself and his associates had made out that they commanded. And indeed, it turns out that the White House, specifically the Office of the Vice President, had put pressure on these people in the Defense Department to withhold their support from Mr. Chalabi in February after they learned that Mr. Chalabi had been to Iran and had been conferring with the hardliners within the Iranian regime.
Without telling his United States patrons?
Well, that's a good question, because I do know that he had some U.S. people with him who had very strong ties to the administration. The question is whether or not they informed the administration. Now, it just so happens that I was in Mr. Chalabi's headquarters in northern Iraq the night he arrived back from Iran, and I can tell you that these people were extremely elated by the reception they had received in Iran.
Well, if a man was expecting to be the next head of state of Iraq, it wouldn't seem necessarily such a bad idea to touch base with the big neighbor Tehran.
Maybe not, but at the same time, one has to remember who the people he was meeting with. These people are the people, according to U.S. and other officials, who have been supplying weapons to Hezbollah, have been supporting anti-American terrorism around the world, have a anti-American bent in their foreign policy, have opposed the moderates in Iran,
sure,
reforging ties with the United States, and in fact had been training and arming an Iraqi Shiite militia and had started sending them back into Iraq, ostensibly to fight the regime, and in fact they did nothing. They sat out. They sat out that entire campaign. Mm. I know because I was there. Mm.
But Jonathan Landay, Ahmad Chalabi hardly looks like a clerical ruler in waiting. But I guess the larger question here is, was there no pushback? I mean, if you were a betting person, you would say, well, here's like the golden scenario, that everything falls right in line and that, you know, we walk right into these government offices of Saddam and run them the next day. It's just a push-button turnkey operation. How could someone go responsibly to war without plan B, C, D?
There absolutely was pushback. It was coming from the CIA, the State Department, and other parts of the government. And the fact is there was an interagency process. There were deliberations over Iraq policy. But we were told by very senior people that these deliberations were, in fact, ignored by the Pentagon planners, who had their own ideas. Their ideas were were heavily disputed both by the CIA and the State Department. And the fact is, if you look at the State Department and how they were planning for post-Saddam Iraq, they had a project going on for about 8 months or more called the Future of Iraq Project, in which 17 agencies of the U.S. government, including the Pentagon, and dozens of Iraqi expatriates, people who belong to the established opposition parties as well as independents, were participating, and they were putting together plans for everything from rebuilding the judicial system to how to restore the environmental degradation in the southern marshes, which had been drained.
So why not just lean on those plans now? Why not pull those out of the drawer?
This project was ignored. And in fact, we were told by two people that the director of the project, the first U.S. administrator in Iraq, former Lieutenant General Garner, had requested this man be placed on his team, and this was vetoed by civilians in the Defense Department.
So they just weren't going to have it. Jim Pinkerton, what do you make of this story as it unfolds?
That's pretty interesting. Who was the fellow they vetoed, by the way?
Tom Warrick.
Okay. I mean, it sounds like an FSO or something, right? I mean, a Foreign Service officer.
He's been in the State Department for quite a long time. Before this, he was in the Office of War Crimes.
Yeah. See, in other words, the Pentagon was not going to let the State Department run this operation. The Pentagon had their own ideas on nation building. I completely agree that they had all their chips on Chalabi, who has worked this town hard in terms of sort of the neoconservative Republican establishment for a decade now. They didn't want somebody they didn't trust from the State Department running the show.
But this turns out to be a pretty giant miscalculation. Jim Pinkerton, we hear rumblings even in the neoconservative camp now that this is giving the whole project a bad name, that somebody ought to pay for the bad planning. What do you think?
Well, I have no doubt in my mind that half a dozen neoconservatives, probably including some in the government right now, are working away on their memoirs, where they're going to say that so-and-so, Bush, Powell, Garner, whoever, let them down, betrayed them. I'm sure that this is going to be a huge boomlet in the Weekly Standard.
You mean let them down by not going with Chalabi?
Well, whatever. I mean, one thing, the neocons who propagandized their way into this war to begin with and sort of persuaded the American people that after Afghanistan attacked us that the real enemy was Iraq, that one thing they're never going to fall down on is lacking publishing opportunities.
Jonathan Landy.
Yeah, let me just add that they've already started saying this. As part of our article, we had an email exchange with the man who was in charge of policy at the Defense Department, Douglas Fife, and we put it to him in a question that was the plan to put Ahmad Chalabi in charge, and he categorically denied it. And at the same time, we did an on-the-record interview with Richard Perle, who was the chairman of the Defense Policy Board, a man who was extremely close to Chalabi, one of the main proponents of putting Chalabi in power, and someone who is close to Douglas Fife, who acknowledged on the record that indeed that was the plan, and he blamed the State Department and the CIA for refusing to go with it, and he blames them for the planning failures and the circumstances in which the U.S. troops now find themselves.
So is Douglas Fife saying now that if only Chalabi would have been put in the president's chair, everything would have been fine?
No. He denied that that was the plan, but Richard Perle says. Perle says. Absolutely.
Well, callers want to join us. Let's invite them in. Joanne's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Joanne. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah. I'm glad you brought up the issue about the State Department. I think that the current government, which I look at led by Rumsfeld right now, this civilian military group, is just supremely arrogant and ignorant of the history of what's gone on. And they like to sort of couch things in terms of good versus evil, and it's all black and white, and we're going to go in there, and this is what's going to happen.
And yet there's a country here that we're now attached to and that needs to stand up. How do we help it?
That's the question. I think I do think people need to be held accountable for what the State Department was saying. I remember NPR reporting on that.
I think you mean the Department of Defense, which was really the driver before the war, but point taken there.
The other thing is the rest of the world kind of knew what was going to happen, I think. You look at Europe and the UN, who's been in rebuilding zones, and they're really the experts with that. And we said, no, we're going to do this. We can go it alone. So why didn't we look to the experts in rebuilding as well?
Well, and now we're trying to. Joanne, let me put that to Jonathan Landay. Jonathan, India has just said, no, thank you. We won't be sending 17,000 troops The Pentagon was fairly happy to do things on its own earlier. How badly do they want international support now?
Well, as a matter of fact, I reported about a week and a half ago that Mr. Bremer, although he has not made the formal request, has been asking for extra troops. Now, this was denied by his people.
Extra American troops?
No, this was perhaps maybe the one fault in my reporting is that I reported that he was asking for American troops. Mm-hmm. This was denied. Mm-hmm. In fact, what subsequently has learned that he's just asking for troops. He needs bodies. He doesn't have enough. And the Defense Department has been going to NATO, has been going to other countries, including Pakistan and India, and other countries, trying to get troops, trying to get an international peacekeeping force to go into Iraq.
Any luck yet? Yeah.
The problem is money. The problem is it also in the case of India, a UN, they want a UN imprimatur on this. Mm-hmm. That doesn't exist. And the fact is that I reported in the same story that the Bush administration has been going and talking to the Gulf Arab nations as part of an effort to put together a fund from which that they would fund, from which would be drawn the money to pay for participation by other troops in a peacekeeping operation in Iraq. Now, mm-hmm. I don't know how far that fundraising effort has gone.
Does that mean Washington would even look at this point for a United Nations imprimatur, as you say?
That would be... I can't see that happening, although if they get desperate enough, they might actually do that. But don't forget that the Defense Department was opposed entirely to internationalizing this entire operation right from the start, and opposed the fact that Colin Powell prevailed in his arguments that they should go to the United Nations and try and get a United Nations backing for this operation.
Well, there it is. James Pinkerton, can you see the United States under the pressure, under the weight of the responsibility of rebuilding, looking out not just to international partners, but to the UN itself?
Well, they have UN's Security Council Resolution 1483, which they could probably interpret to say anybody's invited in. Of course, the problem is we're dealing with is there's a lot of democracies in the world now. And so a place like India looks around and says, do we really want to send 17,000 troops into Iraq, no matter how much money the Americans offer us, is that can be popular with the folks back home, including the 140 million or so Muslims who live within the Indian border, not to mention the potential trouble they could have with Pakistan and Bangladesh, the two Muslim countries on the east and west, respectively. So I could easily see how this could get very tough. I think if you took a poll right now and asked Americans, would you like to go? Would you do it all over again if you could? I suspect most Americans would say no, and I'm not really too surprised that Indians and perhaps other governments feel the same way.
And Jim Pinkerton, you come from a conservative background. You worked in the Reagan and Bush one administrations, and still we hear this interpretation from you.
Well, I would like to think that I was consistent all the way through. Some might argue, but I think that I was always a sort of classical liberal, a pro-free market, anti-interventionist, anti-imperialist fellow who associated with people like the British economists Cobden and Bright, who were abolished the tariffs.
And with all that, a Reagan man, Jim Pinkerton, Jonathan Lande, please stand by. We're talking tonight about Iraq for the long haul. Does America have the wherewithal, the will to rebuild this country, to get this job done? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Iraq for the long haul, about chaos, guerrilla war, and an endurance test for the United States. You can join the conversation as well. Is there any doubt in your mind that this is the right, the necessary project for America now, given everything that's transpired? Should the rest of the world step up and help, or is this America's baby? And what does your crystal ball show you in Iraq's future? We're at 1-800-423-8255. My guests tonight are James Pinkerton. He's a former White House aide in the Reagan and first Bush administrations. He's a Newsday columnist and a Fox News contributor, just recently returned from Iraq. And Jonathan Lande, national security correspondent for the Knight Ridder Washington Bureau. He's been breaking stories about the inner workings of what was expected in Iraq and what's actually been found there. You can join us as well. Nick is calling from Weston, Massachusetts. Hi, Nick. You're on the air.
How are you?
Fine, thanks.
I think it's crucial that the people responsible for not heeding the planning that was done by think tanks and government agencies, State Department and other agencies, those people must be held accountable. And I think that I'm hoping that the Senate will hold hearings on this. I think this is much more serious than the matter of weapons of mass destruction, of cooking the evidence of weapons of mass destruction. I think it's there. Well, perhaps they're of equal seriousness.
And what does being held accountable mean in your mind, Nick?
I mean resignations on a high level. I mean, at least Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, Pearl is sort of out of the picture.
Yes, he is.
Still on the defense advisory.
Yeah, but no longer chairman. Well, let me put it to our guest, Jonathan Landay. Can you imagine, given how much the Bush administration has invested in this whole project, that it would, in fact, see these guys walk even an inch out on the plank?
You know, it's hard for me to say, and I'm not even sure that I should be commenting on that question.
Well, in the sense that you've been talking to people inside the administration.
Well, there was a report last week in the Washington Post that Doug Fife was on his way out. I don't know that that's the case. I think, though, the caller makes a very important point, and that is there were people at a very high level who were responsible for ensuring that all of the contingencies that were possible to encounter in this operation were taken into account, and that there were options. And ultimately, we know that the president signed an order that was asked for by Rumsfeld, giving the Defense Department primacy in this over the entire Iraq operation, not just including the military aspects, but also the reconstruction and the political reconstruction, the economic reconstruction.
Does that mean they cannot have their wrists slapped now for ignoring other agencies? They've been given the lead.
First of all, I think there, politically, it would be very, very difficult for the administration to demand resignations and to force anybody to resign right now when it would be an acknowledgement, I think, year before the election or before the as we're going up into a presidential campaign, that mistakes were made, that there were mistakes made. That politically is a very dangerous thing for them to do. But also, it also would allow people perhaps to start, encourage other people to start talking about what happened, and could unleash more revelations about the lack of planning and the incorrect and perhaps false assumptions that were made based on intelligence that may not have been properly vetted or properly received through normal channels, on which a lot of these assumptions were based, and therefore I'm not sure that we're going to start seeing people being forced out or resignations for those reasons. You know, on Friday when George Tenet issued a statement saying that taking responsibility for the inclusion in the President's State of the Union address of the Nigeria uranium, the disputed intelligence on on Iraqi attempts to buy uranium in Africa, there was, you know, the scuttlebutt all over Washington right away was up Tenet's toast, he's gone, and I'm not even sure that's the case, actually.
James Pinkerton, what about it? On balance, the White House is pushing back. Today, they called the whole flap over intelligence a bunch of bull. President Bush said his intelligence in general was darn good and that his administration made the right decision. This is, by any measure, is not going well right now. But in spite of that, do you think Washington did make the right decision to get Saddam Hussein out of there, to go in and be sure there were not weapons that might have been put in hands that would put them at the throat of the United States or others?
My personal view is no. It was a mistake. I thought that just that sanctions and strangling the guy would work when I believed, foolishly, after 23 years in Washington, that he really did have all these weapons of mass destruction. I must confess that I lacked enough cynicism to even entertain the possibility that the whole business, all those exact specific this picture of that and that picture of this and the tapes and the, you know, all the transcripts and so on, all including the stuff about the yellow cake, I just couldn't believe that all of it was if not a lie, at least not quite true. And therefore, because of that, because there's so much momentum behind this, I agree with Jonathan that Tenet probably has survived because he took all the blame and was a good sport about it and took the bullet, as they say down here, that nothing will happen necessarily right away. The Republicans control the Senate and the House, and they therefore the agendas of the investigating committees are going to be probably substantially circumscribed on this.
But are you really writing off all the concern about the threat from Iraq that we saw before the war? You're simply saying misplaced, made up? I mean, it wasn't just the Americans who were expressing concern at that point, of course.
I mean, you're right. I mean, the point is lots of people were concerned, and that's why the UN Security Council voted 14-0 to authorize inspectors just to go see for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so Blix, you remember him, was running around for 3 months looking for stuff, said he couldn't find anything and couldn't find anything. Well, I guess he couldn't find anything because there wasn't anything to be found. You got to at least consider that possibility. So what you do before you declare war, before you commit yourself to $100 billion or $200 billion or $1 trillion worth of warfare and reconstruction, what you do is you think about it hard and you, as they say, measure twice and cut once. Maybe we should have taken yes for an answer when the Iraqis agreed to be prostrate before our inspectors. And even if you remember in the very run-up to the war, the French were saying, well, how about forcible inspections? How about landing troops there to make forcible? Now, that sounds like a pretty good deal in retrospect, doesn't it?
Well, maybe it does. Jonathan Landay, where do you think this is going to go? Just straight into the big melting pot of the presidential campaign or somewhere that could lead to more, I don't know, to resignations, to firings?
I don't think we've seen the end of this. I think that we're going to continue to see things coming out regarding judgments that were made, analyses that were made, intelligence. Look, there's already evidence that the administration, and I think it's a very plausible thing to say, I've written it, that the administration's case was based on much of its case was based on faulty evidence or intelligence that was only discussed partially. And let me explain what I say.
Just a minute left.
Mm-hmm. The first example would be the contention by the president, both before the United Nations and the nation in October in his speech in Cincinnati, regarding the nature of the aluminum tubes that had been intercepted on their way to Iraq. He made categorical statements in both cases that these tubes were for the Iraqi nuclear program. It was only a little later that the CIA disclosed that, in fact, this judgment was in dispute. They said that a majority of analysts believed that these were for centrifuges, which are used to enrich uranium for nuclear weapons, but that there were analysts who believed that this is not true. And subsequent reporting that I did showed that, in fact, there was a dissent on this from the State Department, and most importantly, the Department of Energy, which oversees the American centrifuge program. This is where the repository
said, wait a minute. So a lot of aggressive interpreting here. Jonathan Landay, we are out of time, but we're grateful to you for joining us tonight. Thank you so much for being on. Jonathan Landay is national security correspondent for Knight Ridder in Washington. And James Pinkerton, thank you for joining us tonight. Great to have you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Jim Pinkerton is former White House aide to the Reagan and first George Bush administrations. He's a columnist for Newsday and a contributor to Fox News. He just returned from 2 weeks in Iraq. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, a Democratic presidential candidate in the hot seat for his support of the Iraq War. This is On Point. Controversy over pre-war intelligence and post-war problems in Iraq may be centered on the Bush administration, but Democrats who voted for the war have not been able to entirely escape controversy themselves. Yesterday, presidential candidate Dick Gephardt was put in the hot seat at a Heartland Forum gathering in Dubuque, Iowa. When taking audience questions, Gephardt came under fire for supporting the Iraq War. In this excerpt from the forum, you'll hear first Dubuque resident Art Roach ask for an apology from the House Majority Leader for granting congressional approval for war. Gephardt's response was then interrupted by another audience member who wasn't satisfied by the candidate's answer.
We're in the 10th week of the military occupation of Iraq. You participated in the decision to go to war. I've yet not heard any contrition, any remorse from any member of Congress. And I'm going to have a hard time voting for any candidate who voted for the war until I hear that. Thank you.
I appreciate and respect your views deeply. You try to do what you think is right, and you never know completely if you are right. After 9/11, I was in a meeting with the president probably most every Tuesday morning in the White House. I said also to him in January or February of last year that we had to go to the UN if he wanted to deal with weapons in Iraq. He said to me, I need to show that America is behind me or I can't get the UN. And I said, fine, I'll help with that, but I want language in the resolution that says three things that I feel very strongly about. I said, first, I want language that says you're going to do everything you can to get the UN behind us. Second, I want to know the plan for the aftermath so that we know the limits of what has to be done and what it's going to cost the American people. Third, I want to know how doing this, if we do it, conflicts with the war against terrorism. That language got into the resolution. I voted for the resolution. Now we get evidence that perhaps some of the things the president was saying to the American people and to the Congress may not have been true. That's a very serious situation. This is a democracy. The one thing you know is that you've got to maintain credibility between the leaders, the government, and the people.
How can you say that? Niger, that was the European press.
Stand up.
That was the European press. They won't work. When the same thing didn't happen, people were skeptical about it. How can you act like the past did not happen? There was outrage about that. People died because there was a lack of courage. And I applaud you that they're questioning it now. They're questioning the president now. But questioning does not bring people back from the dead.
I deeply respect your views. All I'm saying is that I did the best I knew how to do in my judgment, in my heart, in my mind, for what it would take to keep our people safe.
But in hindsight, that was a mistake, right?
We need, and I will insist on a full, complete bipartisan inquiry in the open to find all the facts. We got to get every fact out. We got to get every fact of what the intelligence was and wasn't, how it was handled or mishandled. And finally, we need to get all the facts on where the weapons are, if the weapons exist, where they went, and what happened. And when we get all the facts on the table, then all of us can look back on what we did and what we decided and whether or not it was the right thing. Look, I will never tell you that I know everything. But one thing I can tell you is I will give every effort that I can to find the facts, to make a judgment based on what I believe in my heart is the best thing to keep this country safe.
Democratic presidential candidate Dick Gephardt yesterday in Dubuque, Iowa. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.